This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This is a crowd podcast.
We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Hemingway.
Eichmann.
Yachman.
Hello and welcome to episode 83 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the podcast that explores post-war history and the reason why the world is like it is today, all done through the lyrics of a number one smash hit from the legend that is Billy Joel. I am Tom Fordyce.
I'm Katie Puckrick.
Katie, are we ready for the next part of our adventure?
We are, and it's a very deep and dark adventure. Today we are discussing the life and times of the architect of the Holocaust, the Final Solution, Adolf Eichmann, who in 1960 was captured by Mossad operatives in Argentina and taken to Israel to be tried for crimes against humanity and war crimes. And to talk to us today about all of this is Stephen Luckert, who is the senior program curator in the Levine Institute for Holocaust Education at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Stephen has spent 20 years as the curator of the museum's acclaimed permanent exhibition, The Holocaust, and he's published on German history, the Holocaust, and Nazi propaganda. Welcome, Steve.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Steve, this is an extraordinary story. Before we fully excavate the grimness of Adolf Eichmann's history and his actions, can you just quickly give us an overview of who Eichmann was and why this was such a sensation when he was captured in Argentina?
Well, Adolf Eichmann was born in Germany about 1906, and he joined the Nazi Party in Austria as well as the SS in 1932. And he quickly rose through the ranks and eventually became the expert on Jewish issues within the Reich Security Service. And he was responsible for first working for the mass forced emigration of Jews from Austria, then Germany, and elsewhere. Then he became involved in various types of plans to solve the so-called Jewish question. And ultimately, he was involved in planning the deportations of Jews to killing centers in Europe and the mass murder of millions.
And why was it such a big hoo-ha when he was captured? Because he wasn't captured right after the war. It was some years later, right?
Yes, it was a number of years later. In fact, he was captured by American troops after the war, but he was using a false name. But he eventually made his way to Argentina in 1950, and it was only 10 years after that that he was captured by the Mossad and brought to Israel. And this was something that just the event, the drama behind this, and the capture of this man who was already known after the Nuremberg trials for his role in what came to be known as the Holocaust.
The first question I have, Stephen, and from all my reading about Eichmann, your skin crawls for the majority of it. It's one of the most horrendous human beings you will ever read about. And I find myself wondering how he became like that, what it was about his childhood or the situation in Germany as he was growing up that could turn someone into the monster that he became.
Well, you raise a very important question, and one that's difficult to answer in many ways, because, you know, here's somebody who, you know, really hadn't been much of a success in his life. You know, he didn't do very well in school. He tried to, you know, work for his father in Austria. That didn't pan out well. And he gravitated towards far-right politics and joined the Nazi Party. The year before the Nazi Party came to power in Germany, he joined. So his politics were already there with this far-right anti-Semitic group. And he joined the SS. And And the SS was kind of this elite, started out as a bodyguard for Adolf Hitler, but in the 1930s greatly expanded. And Eichmann was part of that. And he took this growing interest in the Jewish question. What's kind of remarkable is that he showed great organizational skills in carrying this out. This is a guy that had never done particularly well before, but he showed an aptitude for brutalizing populations, for organizing mass murder.
I'm wondering what animated Eichmann's anti-Semitic beliefs. I mean, was it something that he picked up in his family, or it was just kind of the popular position to take at that time?
Well, it's hard to, there isn't all that much about his early life. We know something about his early life, but not enough to say, you know, did it come from his upbringing? Certainly gravitating towards the circles that he was, these kind of far right, you know, Nazi circles in the 1930s. Remember, he's still fairly young.
Political theorist Hannah Arendt, in her book Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil, did characterize him as a joiner, someone who perhaps doesn't have that much of, you know, gumption and grit within himself, but is really happy to join something that's already in progress.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there were many people. You have to realize that, you know, and sometimes we forget about this, but how quickly the Nazi Party rose, for instance, in Germany. I mean, in 1928, for instance, the Nazi Party had 12 seats in the German parliament, the Reichstag, out of about 500. 1930, they get 107 seats. 1932, 230. So this is a meteoric rise, and millions of people switch their allegiances from centrist parties to the Nazi Party. And the Nazis were successfully able to market themselves as an alternative. And there were people that overlooked, for instance, the rabid anti-Semitism and looked to the, you know, Hitler's appeals to creating a Germany that would unite all the people regardless of what region they came from, what class they belonged to, and what religion, as long as they were not Jews. Jews were excluded. They were deemed to be a foreign race. And so Eichmann was one of those that was drawn to that. But he went much further in the sense that he joined the most ideological Nazi part of that movement, that is the SS.
Okay, so that's why the Nazi Party makes sense for Eichmann. What is it about Eichmann that sees him progress so quickly through the Nazi Party ranks?
It's through this kind of, through the SS and through the Reich Security Service that he rises up. He first is given, you know, tasks. One of his tasks was dealing with Freemasonry. So he got involved in kind of ideological enemies of the Reich. And then he moved into dealing with the Jewish question. And one of the things that I think he realizes is the kind of personal power that he has. And this is something that he, I think, thrives on. It gives him a sense of personal empowerment, but also, you know, I think he feels that this is, you know, an accomplishment.
What sort of situations were the Jewish population in Germany put through in the 1930s as the Nazi Party tightens its grip on the country? What sort of deprivations were being forced upon the German Jews?
Well, when you look at the Nazi Party, the core of its ideology, one of the key elements of it is anti-Semitism, a racial anti-Semitism. When Adolf Hitler came into power, he immediately began to implement many of his measures. And we forget how quickly this happened. But, you know, he's appointed January 30th, 1933. And within 6 months, Germany goes from being a republic with over 30 political parties to being a one-party state. Less than 6 months. And then, you know, he immediately begins implementing measures so that in that first 100 days, you have the civil rights taken away from all Germans, and that remains until 1945. You have the first concentration camps set up. you have the first anti-Jewish legislation put forward, all within the first 100 days of the Nazis taking over. And what they did is that they tried to, first of all, identify Jews, Jewish businesses. And the goal was, at least in Germany up until the fall of 1941, was to force Jews to leave. That was the goal, that all these laws to disenfranchise Jews, to drive them from the economy, was to push them out. And Eichmann played an important role in that. And he showed skills that in doing this that won him the praise of colleagues in the SS, that he was so successful in doing that, particularly, you know, in 1938, after the incorporation of Austria into the German Reich.
I'm interested in the fact that before they hit on the final solution strategy, the idea of simply exterminating their enemies, the first idea was to set up Jewish ghettos and then reservations for Jews abroad, including one in Madagascar, which, to my ignorant mind, sounds like a charming idea, like having a holiday on a desert island somewhere. But that's not how it was actually devised, was it, Steve?
No. I think that with the coming of war, one of the things that the Nazis discussed, particularly within the SS, is to come up with a solution to this Jewish question. If forced emigration, forcing Jews out, you know, ran into difficulties, then you create these reservations. So Eichmann worked on one, you know, the so-called Nisko reservation near Lublin. That also kind of failed. But this kind of search for plans, the Madagascar plan was one of those. That is this island off of Africa. It had been talked about actually years before, both by the Polish government, and there was even a expedition that was taken there to see if, in fact, people could be settled there. And that was something that the Nazis considered, that they could deport Jews there, of course, under brutal conditions. That is, was not supposed to be, you know, a tropical paradise. This was supposed to be a place where Jews would be put to work, and many of them would die as a result of that. But it was the idea of cleansing Germany and its occupied territories of all Jews. And that was something that Eichmann had discussed and worked on. So he was very much involved in these kind of discussions about plans, how to solve this so-called Jewish question.
And when did the policy change from forced emigration to genocide?
Well, that really, it's about 1941. One of the things that occurs is that when you have the outbreak of the Second World War, which Nazi Germany initiated, it cuts off the possibilities for Jews to emigrate. As Nazi power grows, they incorporate more and more Jews under their control. So they embarked in 1941 upon mass murder.
Who were the architects of this final plan, Stephen? Which members of the Nazi hierarchy?
Well, of course, Adolf Hitler you'd have to put in at the very top. But people like Heinrich Himmler, who was the Reichsführer SS, you know, Reinhard Heydrich, also a member of the SS, and one of Eichmann's superiors. And Eichmann played a role in this too. The first mass killings occurred through shootings. After the invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941, the SS troops there carried out mass shootings of Jews. And in a period of, you know, little more than 6 months, they'd killed about 1 million Jews. If you think about places like Babi Yar outside of Kiev in Ukraine, in 2 days, they murdered over 33,000. But this was something that was carried out repeatedly in villages and towns and cities throughout the occupied East. Then, of course, this moved into the idea of having this occur on a continental scale. And so Eichmann played a role in that. January of 1942, you have this the so-called Wannsee Conference to discuss the implementation of this horrific plan.
So before the Wannsee Conference, it was a little bit ad hoc, this repulsive orgy of murder. And then I guess those in charge, and including Eichmann, decide we need to make this a more efficient system. Presumably he was instrumental in streamlining this murder. What were his responsibilities and actions from this time going forward?
Well, one of the things that he did is he played a role both in the organization of that particular conference, but it's also dealing with the deportations of Jews from Germany, first initially in 1941 to the Eastern Killing Zones in the Soviet Union, then with deportations to ghettos, and eventually deportations to killing centers. That is, they created these special camps where Jews were to be eradicated on a mass scale, so that Jews from all over. And so this required a lot of coordination between various German agencies. So Eichmann showed his skills as an organizer in carrying out this mass murder.
And how quickly did it take place, Stephen, once it had begun?
Well, it occurs quite rapidly. So you have the Wannsee Conference. You've already started one killing center in operation, Chełmno, at the end of December of 1941. And then you had several camps, the so-called Operation Reinhardt camps, that opened in 1942 that were just for mass murder in gas chambers. And so you had transports that were from Poland, from the Netherlands, and various others. And, of course, you had the creation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. Auschwitz, which started out as a concentration camp, rapidly expanded to the greatest mass graveyard in Europe. And Eichmann was involved in having those deportations from throughout Europe to go to Auschwitz and other places.
Was there ever a sense that the people who were being funneled to their doom, that they could also maybe be used as a workforce, a slave workforce? Because I know that people were just shoved into these trains with no food or water, and it didn't seem to matter if they didn't make the trip.
Well, they did exploit labor in a huge way. But for the vast majority of Jews that were deported to these killing centers, they weren't registered for forced labor. The concentration camp system greatly expanded during the war to use forced labor, many of them non-Jews, in various types of projects for armaments manufacturing, construction of fortifications. And Jews were used for this as well, but in relatively smaller numbers. So you have labor being exploited. And if you think about, for instance, the size of the concentration camp population and the beginning of 1945, it's about 700,000 people that are registered. And those are for mostly for forced labor. And so the Nazis exploited labor to a great deal. But for the vast majority of Jews, it meant death. In Auschwitz, for instance, you had this selection process that divided up those Jews that were seen that could work, you know, that could be selected for forced labor and those that couldn't. So that elderly Jews, young children, pregnant women were immediately sent to the gas chambers to be murdered.
The terrible scale of the death, Stephen, suggests words like indiscriminate, but I think almost what's most frightening is that it wasn't indiscriminate, that the level of organization that went into these executions, even when Germany invades Hungary quite late in that war in March 1944, by July, almost 500,000 Hungarian Jews have been sent to their deaths.
Yeah, and this is something that, you know, when you think about Germany's clearly losing the war, but when they move into Hungary, it's people like Eichmann who are so dedicated to this cause that they want to eradicate this large population of Jews, even as they know they're going to lose the war. This is their goal. This is the mindset to carry out mass murder. Eichmann, you know, goes to Hungary. He negotiates with Jewish leaders, organizes these mass deportations.
And Steve, I'm interested in this detail you just mentioned, that he negotiates, Eichmann negotiates with Jewish leaders. What form does that discussion take? I mean, why wouldn't the leaders be going, go away, you horrible person?
Well, this is something that Eichmann had begun doing in the 1930s. And maybe negotiation isn't the right word, because it's not negotiating between people of equal power. That is, Eichmann knew he was in the driver's seat. So he could bully them into doing that, into pressuring them, for instance, in forced emigration, to get them to pressure the Jewish community to sign up to leave. You know, and of course, what you have to remember is that they're not saying to Jews, you're going to be sent to your deaths. It's all about forced labor, or you're going to be deported to the East.
Right. And of course, it's important to say that Jews weren't the only people who were targeted.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you look at the, you know, the number of victims of the Nazi regime, and that includes everyone from, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses to men who engage in same-sex relationships, political opponents, Soviet prisoners of war, Polish civilians, persons with disabilities, you know, Roma and Sinti. Within the Nazi universe, these were all groups that constituted potential threats to the Nazi regime.
As the war in Europe comes towards its conclusion, Stephen, and Stalin's armies are advancing from the east and the Allies are advancing from the west, you get a sense of chaos for the area in the middle. And is that why, initially, Eichmann is able to escape?
Well, I think that in some cases, some of these officials are already kind of planning their escape, that they know the end is near. Eichmann is one of those people that he knew all about these routes that people could travel. He knew about false papers. He knew about, you know, the kind of ways in which he could plot his own escape.
How does the process work then for all these Nazis who will find their way to South America and Argentina in particular? There seems like there is an established network to get former SS officers out of Germany, often involving safe houses in monasteries and members of the clergy who are sympathetic to the cause?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes it's called the rat line, you know, where these former Nazi leaders are able to find passage through various countries and particularly get to Italy and then through South America. And all along the way, they're provided with false papers, places to stay. The Allies, of course, have been putting together lists of alleged war criminals who were to be subject to arrest. And of course, that was a very difficult task, because you think about all the German POWs that they had to search through and comb through to identify, you know, is this person a member of the SS? Is this person on this list of war criminals? Many of these perpetrators have assumed identities or have gone underground. And so it becomes a question of rooting these people out, finding out where they are. And of course, they have this network of people that help hide them.
It seems like Argentina is the ideal retirement plan for any self-respecting ex-Nazi. Once he ended up in Buenos Aires, did he socialize or fraternize at all with his former contingent, or were they all just keeping a distance from each other?
Well, I think with Eichmann, he met with a number of, you know, former SS and, you know, Nazi leaders that had fled there. There was an established German community there, but then there was this influx of Nazis that came from Europe, all using fake identities, all, you know, having fake documents that will allow them to come into Argentina. And of course, you had the kind of acquiescence of the Argentinian authorities to letting them in. Eichmann, when you think about it, he was able to survive underground in Germany for 5 years.
Wow.
After the war, and only made it to Argentina in 1950. And of course, he left his wife and children behind.
I'm interested in how wily he was. So, you know, this is someone who was not a great student in high school and kind of flubbed out of his vocational education and wasn't a great employee in his dad's business. And then, of course, found his métier, destroying and annihilating human beings. But I'm wondering if there are accounts of what kind of employee he was in the forestry commission, or when he was a chicken farmer, or as he ended up in Buenos Aires, a department head in the Mercedes-Benz factory. Do we know anything about that?
Well, I mean, we know that he moved from job to job. And, most of these jobs that he had in Argentina were things that didn't, you know, pay a lot of money. And he wasn't, one of the things that some have noted about Eichmann is that unlike other Nazi leaders, he didn't abscond with a lot of money. So he took these jobs, you know, and I'm not sure how successful he was in a lot of these ventures, you know, as well.
He wasn't implying himself to rise to the ranks of Mercedes-Benz necessarily.
Who knew, Stephen? Who knew that Eichmann was in Argentina? I'm assuming that Juan Perón, who we've covered, Katie, in a previous episode, I'm assuming that Juan Perón knew the identity of some of the Germans who were coming. But did other nations know? Did the new government in West Germany know? Did the Americans know?
Well, there's some indications, you know, about the ways in which Eichmann and others disguised their whereabouts. There were many of those who thought that he had gone to the Middle East. One of the things that people believed about Eichmann, including Jewish leaders and some of the initial accounts of him, was that he had been born in Palestine, you know, prior to the State of Israel, that he was born into this German colony and he spoke Hebrew and he spoke Yiddish. And so people said, oh, well, he would flee there to first to Cairo or other places in the Middle East. And there were Nazis that fled there. But there were indications, for instance, in the West German Secret Service that Eichmann was in someplace in Latin America. And one of these things was passed on to the CIA. Now, there's a big debate about how much the CIA knew. You know, were they trying to cover it up? Some recent things that were done by, for instance, Eli Rosenbaum, who headed the Office of Special Investigations that looked into hunting down Nazi war criminals in the United States, has argued that, you know, the information that they got was pretty minimal at best. You know, and so that in those records, there isn't much that would have been useful. And others were getting that information. We know that, for instance, Fritz Bauer, a German Jewish prosecutor in Germany, had received information directly from a survivor who was in Argentina, whose daughter was going out with one of Eichmann's sons. And he reported, the father reported this information to Bauer, and Bauer sent this information on to the Mossad in Israel. And so that helps, you know, uncover Eichmann.
But how incredible, Steve, that this daughter of a Holocaust survivor is dating Eichmann's son. And the story goes that the son was bragging on his dad, like, hey, my dad was responsible for killing those nasty Jews. I mean, presumably not quite understanding the audience he was pitching to.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's kind of one of those extraordinary stories. And it's interesting that Eichmann's wife and the children came over and used their last name.
Yeah.
His last son was born in Buenos Aires. So it's this is kind of this, you know, story about how initially they're told they're going to see an uncle.
Right.
Then Eichmann says, I'm your father. And of course, Eichmann in those Argentinian days takes pride in what he does. There's that series of interviews he does with a Dutch SS man.
Well, this is extraordinary, Stephen, yes. Because this takes place in 1956, at a point where you would think he would still be
laying low.
But instead, yeah, he decides that he wants a biography written of his nefarious deeds and submits to 4 months of interviews, putting on the record everything he has done.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing story. And now that, you know, so many of these things are available, including some of these tapes, you know, the transcripts, you know, as well as the information that came out of the trial, it's quite remarkable. And the kind of pride he takes in what he did. Remember, this is, from his perspective, this was the pinnacle of his career, so to speak. And he took pride in what he did. He's careful in that he goes over a number of these transcripts and he corrects those. He says, no, this isn't how I want this to be presented. So he's clearly thinking in terms of how he wants to be presented.
Yeah, his legacy.
Exactly. And he does the same thing with his trial. And of course, there's an attempt to kind of mislead.
So, of course, before we get to the trial, let's talk about the capture, because this is total action adventure. So already the breadcrumbs are being laid out. We have the daughter of the Holocaust survivor who's dating the son, gets the word back to the prosecutor in Germany, who then gets the word out to the security forces in Israel. What happens next?
They send groups of Mossad agents to kind of verify that it's him. And so in May of 1960, I think there are about 11 or so agents that are there. They, you know, abduct him and smuggle him out of Argentina.
And that must have been hairy scary, because he's not going to go willingly. So what, they had to presumably drug him?
Yeah, and then he was placed on a special El Al flight back to Israel.
I understand that they disguised him as a drunken airline pilot.
So he was, and they, you know, when they captured him, of course, they put, you know, these taped up goggles over him and got him on board the plane and made it there. And then there was the announcement that the Israeli government made that they had captured Adolf Eichmann.
And this is extrajudicial, though. I mean, can I just ask, this is, I'm sure, a dumb question, but why didn't they just say to the Argentinian government, you've got a bad guy there, we need to get him back and put him on trial? Why couldn't they just do that?
Well, I don't think at that stage there was an extradition treaty between Israel and Argentina. And also there would have been a time lag while they negotiated the transport of Eichmann. And I think while it's possible it could have been arranged, he also could have escaped. Remember, when Eichmann was captured, it put the fear in many of those other Nazis that were hiding out in Argentina. I think Mengele flees to Paraguay as a result of that, because they're all worried that the Mossad are going to capture them. You know, they've been a bit too free in their behavior, and none of them want to be put on trial in Israel for their crimes. But this was a challenge from an international law perspective. You know, Argentina initially makes a representation to the United Nations saying this was a violation of their sovereignty in abducting him. You know, it's largely patched up with Israel. You know, Israel, you know, issues a sort of an apology for this, and, you know, it's kind of let go. And then he's brought to face trial in Jerusalem.
The interrogation that takes place before the trial is a pretty extraordinary thing in itself, Steve. So this goes on for a long time, so long that it provides a transcript which is 3,500 pages long.
Did he think that he would get away with it? Like, if he were crafty enough and kind of massaging the facts into a different shape, did he think that he was going to lessen the punishment?
Well, I think in his defense was aimed at that. That is to show that he was a cog in the wheel, that he was just following orders. Now, this, you know, the following orders defense had been tossed out in Nuremberg, you know, so that it was following superiorities wasn't a deemed to be a legal defense. But it was something that Eichmann and other Nazis, you know, used as their defense.
When you read about the trial, Steve, and you get a full understanding of what Eichmann did and what other Nazis did, you almost make the mistake, or I found that I've almost made the mistake of trying to rationalize it, but it's a situation that you cannot rationalize.
Yeah, it's very difficult to understand how people could willingly take part in the mass murder of innocent individuals on such a grand scale. And, you know, and this is something that scholars and philosophers and others have been trying to, you know, to understand. You know, why do people do these horrific things? Was it the nature of bureaucracy that made it easier for people that were just working at their desks? That, like Eichmann would say, I never killed anybody. I never tortured anybody. All he did was draw plans.
Yeah, because it's not like blood is dripping from his fangs, but I would submit that it's even colder and more monstrous that he's so bland and flat in his effect after all of the harm that he has caused.
Yeah, his, you know, you look at his delivery, you know, this the trial was filmed for television. And it was aimed at an international audience. Remember, Israel didn't have TV until about 7 years after.
Oh, that's incredible. So this would have been designed, this would have been videoed to create maximum public impact worldwide.
Yeah. And in many ways it succeeded in putting the Holocaust on the kind of the front page to raise this awareness of the horrors of the Holocaust. And I think, you know, the other interesting element about this was having about 111 or so survivors speak at the trial. This was unusual. And these weren't necessarily people that knew Eichmann. These were people that suffered as a result of what Eichmann did. This was in many ways set an important precedent in the way modern war crimes trials, for instance, in Cambodia and elsewhere, are being dealt with. That is, to have the survivors of these horrific atrocities speak, to put a human voice on that. You know, in comparison to Eichmann, who is emotionless. And so I think this was in many ways quite important. And the Eichmann trial also was something that raised awareness, not only in Israel and in the United States, but in Germany itself. And you had a number of subsequent trials in Germany that really raised awareness of what happened during the Holocaust.
Because this is important to remember that this is what, like 15 years after the end of World War Two. And so I wonder if at the time Eichmann's trial was playing out, was there maybe a sense of World War II exhaustion or Holocaust exhaustion, like fatigue about it? We don't want to keep hearing about it. So in a way, it was quite useful for people to be confronted with, yes, this really happened. And yes, the repercussions are still playing out.
Yeah, I think in many ways it was a bit of a shock. Remember, the things had changed a lot. You know, many of the war crimes trials, for instance, in Germany had largely ended. You know, there were still efforts to locate them. But, you know, the Cold War had already started. There was a new enemy there. Some of these former Nazis became, you know, useful to,
In the U.S., like, you know, helpfully helping the U.S. build bombs and develop their nuclear capabilities.
Yeah, but I mean, in West Germany, too, many of them became, you know, got involved in various enterprises, built new lives, etc. And there were many that didn't want to talk about that, that wanted to push that behind. Germany was experiencing this economic miracle. You know, they wanted to go on. And to bring back the Holocaust and this horse was for many people very difficult.
So when all of this evidence is being put before him and people affected by his actions are speaking emotionally and movingly, I'm sure he was filled with remorse and demonstrated repentance, right?
No, I don't think that wasn't, you know, that wasn't Adolf Eichmann. You know, he was trying to, at least in front of the court, absolve himself of responsibility. You know, and he did this in this very unemotional way. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Yeah.
To see his behavior on the stand.
So he's found guilty of 15 counts of crimes against humanity at the end of December that year. He's sentenced to death by hanging, and after a brief appeal, he is hung and he is cremated. His ashes are scattered somewhere in the Mediterranean, Steve, I guess precisely so there can be no shrine, there can be no place for people to go and celebrate what he did if they wanted to do so.
This actually was something that occurred even after the Nuremberg trials, because there was that notion, and I think it's still very much alive. You don't want to create a site of pilgrimage to these people for neo-Nazis, that you don't want them to be used to resurrect a Fourth Reich. I think that you don't want them to become heroes. And I think that this is something that both the trials did, is that they exposed these people.
What I was struck by, Steve, when I was preparing for our conversation was how compelled the prosecutors were, and people, in fact, historians in writing about Eichmann after the fact, how compelled they are to really establish, yes, he was instrumental in making the final solution a final solution. Like, I think it was kind of a seductive defense that he had that, oh, I was just following orders. I'm just a good little soldier. I'm a good little boy. Don't slap my wrist on this one. And I'm struck today by, like, yeah, it's completely clear how culpable he was. And yet people still feel compelled to point out every time that, yep, he signed this piece of paper. Yes, he advocated for this train to leave at a certain time. Yes, he said this death camp should be built. It seems to me, and I'd be interested to hear what you think about it, it's almost like he's a new kind of villain. He's like the pencil and paper pushing monster.
Well, I think this is an area that I think we're seeing a lot more research being done on, you know, to look at the varieties of collaboration and complicity that went on during the Nazi period, and the role that, you know, even individuals played. And I think that this is an important area. You know, when you go through these documents, as, you know, as I have, and we've got millions and millions of pages, and, you know, you go through these SS documents and you see that Eichmann has signed off on something, that, you know, that it's a plan to forcibly remove Jews and Poles from areas that Germany wants to incorporate into the Reich. And you see the consequences of it. For him, it's a, you know, he's drawing this plan up, but it means thousands and thousands of people being uprooted from their homes, dumped into another place where there's no provisions for them. And this in turn creates new problems. But it shows the kind of ways in which here's this guy, he's looking at it in terms of a problem that's got to be solved. And he's working this out, and this is how it's going to happen, and this is how many people can be sent there. And it raises that kind of role about, you know, here's a guy that's essentially sitting behind a desk coming up with these plans, and yet it has such horrific consequences for ordinary people.
Stephen Luckett, thank you so much for telling us all about Adolf Eichmann, explaining what happened and explaining the magnitude of his crimes to us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being with you today.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen, each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon, and it was absolutely delicious. These are no-fuss, no-mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff. With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customise your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Katie, I knew that would be a sobering episode.
Oh, so heavy, so heavy.
What we've decided to do, Katie, with this topic, because it is a really big one, yeah, in the period of history that we've chosen to cover, we're going to do a second part on this topic. So next week, we are going to be talking to a Holocaust survivor.
Oh.
And that's Ruth Barnett, who escaped Germany via the Kinder transport in 1939.
This is so fascinating because now we have under our belts all of the information about the very, very bad people who ruined millions of people's lives. And now we'll be talking to somebody who survived it. And that's the thing that I find so incredible, is that somehow humanity can prevail in the middle of all of this grimness. So I can't wait to hear her story.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic meeting Ruth. In the meantime, if you have any ideas for guests who you think might work similarly well on an episode of We Didn't Start the Fire, get in touch with us at fire@crowdnetwork.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us on social media.
We're at Spread That Fire on Instagram and Twitter. And Tom, after that episode, I need a hug.
Come here, Katie.
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.